Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We've got the phones open to start today's program. So if you're not at town meeting somewhere this morning, you can share your town meeting chat here. What do you like about the institution of town meeting, or what don't you love? Have you served as maybe town moderator and want to share some of your experiences? We'd love to hear them. I also bring it back to food anytime I possibly can. So is there some dish you always look forward to when you attend a town meeting? Or is there one that you always took to town meeting and want to share the recipe? 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I still got some presidential stuff that I can share with you. And here's what the rest of the morning then looks like. At 9:30, Julie Brochu will explain how she kept me in Vermont with her B-bomb. At 10 o'clock, we'll speak with Dr. Lasha Shantanritse of Norwich University about the situation in the Ukraine. We'll finish up by learning where I should have eaten when I was in Randolph recently, SAP Restaurant. But let's get to those open phones. Let's get them ringing. Again, our number 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. I did want to read, I mentioned this on Friday, but wanted to read it one more time. Last Wednesday, I had Steve Pappas, the editor of the Times Argus, on with me. And as we were discussing what some of the issues would be, some of the votes would be on town meeting in different central Vermont towns and cities, he got one thing wrong, and he wrote back to me, and I actually heard from a listener, too, who caught it. He said, upon reading my own town report from Plainfield, I realize I misspoke on your show. The justices of the peace are the individuals elected to oversee smooth elections. He said they were listers. Listers, Steve goes on to say, are elected to maintain and update the grand list each year. I'm sorry for misinforming your audience. You should definitely correct that, and he apologizes for his error. And thank you, Steve, for setting the record straight. When he mentioned it, I thought, I never knew that, that's what a lister does, and it turns out he was wrong. So that's why I didn't know it and I never heard it before. Let's start off in Barrie and talk to Steve. Good morning, Steve. What's up?
Good morning, Will. Do you happen to know what the origin or generation of town meetings was?
Well, so if I remember correctly, it started in Europe. And I think it still goes on in places like Switzerland. Now, when I had Susan Clark on the other day, she mentioned it being English in origin, that's about as far as I can venture a guess to.
The town meetings in northern New England out of the meetings of the congregations in the Congregational Church.
Ah.
They would have annual meetings, and among other things, they paid rent on their pews, and they would vote under congregational polity on all matters affecting the congregation. And that led in turn to town meetings. And of course, many town meetings originally were in a local church because there were no other spaces large enough to hold the residents of the town.
Oh, that makes sense. Oh, very interesting, Steve. So the Congregational Church we have to thank for town meetings here in New England. I'll tell you a quick funny story about Congregational Church. The first time I ever went to a wild game supper was over in Danville, which holds the oldest. And I was talking to the head of the church, you know, where it was being held. And at one point, he said to me, it used to be held over at the Congo Church. And I thought, wow, I can't believe a little town like Danville has an African church here.
But they do have a dowser.
To explain the joke, congregational churches are sometimes referred to as Congo churches. So, Steve, hey, thanks for that. That's a great bit of information. All right.
Bye-bye.
All right, take care. On we go now to the Duke of Newbury. Hey, Fred, good morning.
Good morning. I did a little research on my dukedom, and I discovered that it goes back to about 1710. That my grandfather, I think he was probably the third great or the fourth great grandfather, was Frederick the Great, and he was the king of the Northeast Kingdom.
Oh, wow. King of the kingdom, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, it was really good, I thought. So anyways, and I've got a cousin, and he's the Baron of Barry.
The Baron of Barry, gotcha. Well, if your great-great-great-grandfather was Frederick the Great, what do they call you in Newbury? Fred the what?
Oh, no, I'm just the Duke of Newbury. I couldn't be king. It's just too much.
Gotcha.
You know,
so
I mean?
You don't have any kind of nickname. No,
right.
Yeah.
Right, but my mother was the Duchess of Dorchester. That was pretty good.
That is good too. You come from a long line of fake royalty.
Like I said, it goes way back to the early 1700s.
That's fantastic. Do you usually participate in town meeting there in Newbury, Fred?
Unfortunately, no, because I don't have any. I'm without portfolio, so...
Ah, that's right.
I don't bother to do that.
All right, Duke without portfolio.
I let the real people that have portfolio, they can go take care of the business in Newbury.
That sounds great. Thanks, Fred. All right, from Fred, we go to Ted in Shelburne. Morning, Ted.
Good morning. Two items. One is, I'm wondering if the new hip way of referring to bag bomb is B-bomb.
No.
That's a different, okay, because I was thinking of B-bomb as the pollinator plant that hummingbirds and so on love, but okay.
So I'll just give you a little heads up to what we'll be talking about at 9:30. This is a completely different product from bag bomb, which most people know. Although, when we learned from when we talked to Julie Brochu at 9:30, she has been making B-bomb for quite a while, and so I got here in 03, Ted, and
I got here in 63.
But I've been using it ever since, and so we'll talk about that. Yeah, Vermont B-bomb.
I will update my vocabulary and care products.
All right.
The other is, I thought it would be interesting because I'm kind of an advocate. I've never lived in Edison County, but I was noticing the stories this morning that Kaya was talking about. Mm-hmm. And I consider it the Anchor Store is an art gallery in Middlebury. Edgewater Gallery has that super nice spot that used to be some kind of elite woolen or ski goods or something. But anyhow, also, and there is, as maybe a part of the program that was being mentioned to get businesses going after all of the construction and destruction and traffic so on,
right.
There is an art gallery, or no, I'm sorry, an art supply store that opened up maybe as a benefit of that program, but there is now a Sparrow Art Supply on Main Street in Middlebury. I thought that would be worth adding to the Addison County news. And as I say, in the earliest days of the most original Frog Hollow, it was a staple of my distribution system.
That's right.
For pottery. So think about Middlebury as a shopping alternative sometimes down Route 7. There's not too troubling traffic, especially now that the roads have settled down and the railroad can go where it wants to go safely.
Yeah, nice restaurants. And I will tell you, Ted, that probably in a couple months, my 90th anniversary tour will stop in Middlebury. And, you know, we'll talk more about that downtown area, how it's been affected, how it's trying to rebound. But it is a great place to shop and to visit, a beautiful area. So I love taking people there.
I guess I'll just do one more sentence, and that is to say that also that the as the open studios for artists and people begins, Middlebury would be a good area to work around, as that is Memorial Day weekend.
Yes, it is.
And so there we go.
Keep reminding us about that.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ted. Great to talk to you. The floor is open for your comments on this town meeting day as we discuss town meeting with open phones. You can bring up an issue. You can tell us what you do or don't like about town meeting. Thoughts on the Australian ballot. What keeps you interested or entertained when you're sitting there at town meeting? And what's the best potluck item in your town? I know over in, I think it was Marshfield or Plainfield, someone always made a killer maple cream pie. Do I have that right? If we have time, I'll tell you about what I whipped up last night. Matzo lasagna. I had some of the everyday matzah from Charlie there at Patchwork Farm and Bakery in East Hardwick. I hope he's not blanching at the thought of what I did with it, but it was really quite delicious. All right, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. And let's go to Middlebury and talk to Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Rick. Just coincidence that I happen to be from Middlebury. The gallery that you're – caller was talking about used to be called Ski House.
Oh, right.
Ski Haas, and they sold skis and high-end clothing. So that's on that subject. But I happen to be in the assessment world, and there is actually a crossover with the listers, if you will, and the board for civil, the Board of Civil Authority, and that is that the Board of Civil Authority actually is the ones that hear a hearing in regards to an appeal that a property owner may have before the listers. So there's a little bit of crossover there. And then also they are also part of what's called the Board of Tax Abatement, where if a property owner cannot pay their taxes, they hear an appeal for that as well.
Mm. So they do have an important role. I think the reason we brought it up last Wednesday was in Middlesex, there were three open spots for listers and nobody running. So I know town clerk Sarah Merriman was a bit concerned about that.
That has been a problem for many, many years. And actually, a lot of towns have gone over to appointing an assessor now because, unfortunately, the Board of Listers or the job of the listers has become much more complicated. And where we had a lot of people that were retired that used to be on the Board of Listers just don't feel that they can fulfill the duties. So a lot of towns have gone over to utilizing the assessor. And then the Board of Listers, if they do have a board, acts as a supervisory capacity, much like a select board would to a town manager.
Ah, interesting. Bill, thanks for that information. That's great. Great sure. civics lesson right, this morning. All right, take care. All right, let's go on to Marshfield. We've got Lawrence next. Hi, Lawrence.
Good morning, Rick. At town meetings, we don't have a potluck. Plainfield does, so Plainfield. It might be at Plainfield they had that. You know, we have either churches or Marshfield community suppers for a few years.
Yeah.
Did the meals. It's a prepared meal at Marshfield.
All right.
But the what I called was probably about 15, 20 years ago at town meeting. There was the Times Argus had sent a young gentleman to kind of, do a little report on our town meeting.
Right.
And he was a Japanese-American, mm-hmm. a young guy. And early on in the meeting, we had one of our local characters, an older guy, get up. And he did a very impassioned speech about Pearl Harbor.
Oh, my.
We were pretty embarrassed, but now that I look at it, it was pretty funny. But it didn't look like the reporter. It didn't seem to faze him.
I was going
to
say, how'd he take it?
He didn't seem to have much reaction at all.
All right, good.
Just let it go by. But it was like,
Well done. All right. So, how long have you been going to town meeting there in Marshfield, Lawrence?
Since 88.
Yeah. Are you from away, or are you from Vermont originally?
No, I was born in Wisconsin.
So what did you think, you know, when you moved here and were introduced to the institution of town meeting?
I thought it was incredibly great.
Yeah.
And just, you know, getting a chance to be around your neighbors and making some decisions and hearing their opinions, and it was just terrific.
Yeah, I agree. All right, Lawrence, thanks so much for calling in. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, so it must be, I can't remember which town it was. Maybe it was, I'm just making it up. I think it's somewhere along Route 2. Someone made an absolutely wonderful maple cream pie, and, you know, it would always be offered at town meetings. So somebody along Route 2 in one of those towns probably know what I'm talking about, or maybe I'm just making stuff up again. All right, so what else did I want to do? Sometime last week we heard from Bobby, and she had referred to what she heard on CBS Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley, and I just wanted to I went back and listened to it and wanted to let Bobby know what that item was. So first of all, it was a story overall about free speech and a new book on the history of free speech. And the thing that Bobby referred to, I'll give you a little clarity on it, Bobby. So there were state legislatures around the country have been passing laws to limit free speech. In New Hampshire, the law limits a teacher speaking about racism or sexism. And in New Hampshire, there's a group offering a $500 bounty if a teacher does run afoul of this law. So, you know, it was they spoke to a teacher in New Hampshire who was quite worried about, you know, what they could or couldn't say. Because, you know, they could be turned in, lose their right to teach. And that was what Bobby was kind of saying. The other thing that was pointed out in the story was that we still do enjoy more freedom of speech here in the U.S. than in most countries. But it does seem like it is being limited by some of the legislation being passed in some places. All right, we got another Bill, this one in Moortown. Good morning, Bill. What's going on?
Good morning. I was raised up in the Northeast Kingdom.
Yeah?
And in Sutton and Burke, they, of course, that was in the 50s. That was probably when some of the old folks had finally got out for the spring. That was a big day for them.
Yeah, for town meeting, and sure.
Then after the town meeting was over, there was generally a supper or something, and then a dance afterwards.
Oh.
And the dance was the best part of the town meeting day.
I would imagine. Oh, my gosh. I wonder if that was in other towns or if that was a Burke thing.
I'm not sure. I wasn't that old to get out. I was born in the early 40s. So,
mm-hmm.
But I know between Sutton and Burke, Sutton always had a dance.
Oh, man, that would have been fabulous. What a great way to cap off a day of getting out, being with your neighbors.
We still had quite a few of the older people that had buggies or had sleighs and horses that would come to town.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah, it was a big to-do.
Oh, what a great memory, Bill. That had to be fabulous.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I could like to. I can't talk to you on the radio because they'd shut me off. But I could tell you some awful funny stories. It's not too bad that I learned in the first grade in school. So anyway, you have a good day.
All right, way to keep it clean, Bill. Thanks for that great memory. Wow, I'd love to. Maybe we'll have some time tomorrow and we'll talk about it more. But if anybody grew up in a town where they did the same thing. What a fabulous way to finish off town meeting. You know, you get together. First of all, you see all the people you haven't been able to see all winter long. You do the business of the town. You vote on it. You debate it. You figure out you know, the direction you're going to take, and you have a community supper, and then you dance it all off. Everybody enjoys each other's company with dancing, as they did in Burke. That's the first time I'd heard of that. Well, you know, although I don't have a long history of having lived here and knowing about all that. Very interesting stuff. All right. Danny, your ear must be falling off. Did a lot of business there, so we're going to shut the phones down. And a reminder that I will be in Elmore at the General Store this Thursday as part of the WDEV 90th Anniversary Tour. And it is thanks to the generous support of Osborne Family Syrup, Sotheby's Honey, and Elmore Mountain Farm. So thanks to them. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update. Then we'll return to learn about Vermont Bee Balm. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I have developed many wonderful friendships since moving to Vermont, which have helped me settle in, feel at home in this wonderful place. But I honestly credit just one person for helping me survive winter number one after my move north from Miami, Florida, and quite frankly, most every winter since then. Her name is Julie Devlin Brochu, and she is the creator and owner of Vermont Bee Balm in Craftsbury, and she joins us now. Julie, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hi, Rick. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, and I want to thank you for making my life bearable here in the North Country, but we'll get to that. Listeners, if you have a question about Vermont Bee Balm, or if it has saved your hands, you can give us a call, 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Julie, how much do you remember about when I was a morning show DJ with sad hands? It had to be about 18 years ago.
It was a long time ago, yes, but I remember it clearly. I was just talking to my husband, Kelly, about it this morning. I was driving through Morrisville, and I heard this sad plea over the radio, this fellow who had tried everything, and he couldn't get rid of the cracks in his hand.
Yep.
And this was before I had even, you know, come up with containers or anything, and I was just in the beginning phases.
Yeah, so...
I immediately pulled over and called you.
That's right.
I could help you.
Right. And you said you would send me some of your product, right?
Yep. And you said that you would dutifully try them and interview me. And I think it was a week or 2 weeks.
It was just about 2 weeks. And I wasn't sure that was enough time for me to get the product, to use it, and to fix the hands that had just been a mess all winter long. And you said, it'll work.
I had faith.
Yeah. And why? Why were you so confident that this would be what would fix my hands?
Because I had those hands. I was... a nurse's aide back in the mid-80s,
mm-hmm.
and I had to wear those gloves with the powder inside, and I had an allergic dermatitis, which is similar to eczema.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, I couldn't get anything to heal them, and my hands were killing me. Just to get shampoo on my hands felt like acid.
Wow.
So all the ones that you get in the grocery store, all the traditional alcohol-filled petroleum-filled lotions were not helping me. So I started doing some research into natural ingredients. And, for centuries, people have been using beeswax added to some sort of fat to make a balm for their hands. And so I started experimenting and made it for myself, and that's what cured me. So I knew I could help you.
Yeah, and I will say that my hands were cured in time for you to be on the interview with me all those years ago, as you thought they would. First of all, the pain stopped, and then the cracks healed. And to this day, even in the winter, I have I'm going to admit it. I have soft, supple hands, Julie.
Oh. That's so good to hear.
So
it makes us so happy.
Yeah. Now, you said you didn't have, you know, your containers back then. I remember that. You sent me, they were in like baggies, and they were in yes. they were in kind of funny shapes. What did you used to use to make to the shapes or the molds for the bee bomb?
I think I used like those little ice cream containers that are plastic.
Yep,
and we still use containers like that today after we filter our wax, and we want to get a good supply of filtered wax to make our bombs with. We'll pour it into little containers like that, little applesauce plastic containers. We like to reuse and reduce.
If I remember correctly, one looked like kind of like a medallion, and I thought the other one was like a canoe or something.
Yes.
Right? Does that sound right?
Yes, the famous canoe mold, which I found it was an awkward shape. And but you know what? It's fun to look at those molds. On the websites and pick them out.
Yeah, I remember, you know, getting these things and wondering what in the world. This is going to save my hands. This is going to keep me in Vermont, but it did. So, yeah. So, you know, when you developed it, now you talked about beeswax and lard, but that's not exactly what you wound up using for bee bomb, correct?
Correct. I wanted something that people wouldn't be afraid of. And frankly, you know, it's that used to be what they used because that's all they had was animal fats.
Right.
So, but I had read about, like in Europe, they use a lot of olive oil in their skincare products. So I thought, well, I'll just try this out. And it worked, and the olive oil is nice and smooth,
mm-hmm.
and it goes in well. Some oils tend to stay on top of your skin, but this goes right in, and it leaves that beeswax behind, which is a protective coating, as you know, that
yeah.
it makes your hands feel so good.
And the one thing I remember, I would say, is I had to be able to just smooth this on. I was not going to get anything that was too greasy or oily that would require me to wear like cotton or gauze gloves,
mm-hmm.
which is very unsexy. I didn't need that. And you said, no, don't worry about this. The olive oil will soften your hands, will cure the cracks, and the beeswax will kind of form a protective layer over it.
Absolutely. And, you know, when I had my allergic dermatitis, that's the piece that was missing, is I couldn't find a product that would leave that protective coating.
Right.
Everything felt slippery and you know, like just full of alcohol. And so, yeah, I mean, that's what gave me the confidence going forward. And I had such wonderful support from my husband and family, because I tried it out on family and friends.
Here, put this on. see what this does to your hands. And the other thing that's kind of lovely is the smell is beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, how can you go wrong with beeswax? It's just so sweet smelling.
Yeah. Now, if I'm not mistaken, did you have a background in chemistry or physics or something sciencey that helped you as you concocted this bee bomb?
Well, you would think you would need a background in chemistry, which I did have, but I mean, there wasn't a lot of chemistry involved in my mind. It just, you know, after reading about, particularly it's mentioned in one of the Little House on the Prairie books, how Ma used to mix up beeswax with lard and put it on their hands after, you know, a hard day in the field. Yeah, I just lost my train of thought.
Are you telling me that your inspiration was the Little House on the Prairie books?
A big inspiration.
How about that?
Yeah. I mean, how can you get more natural than that? And I read my kids when they were growing up. I read them the whole series.
Yeah. Now, when you started to make it, were you selling it at farmers markets? Is that how you were marketing it to begin with?
Absolutely. What I did is I got some very cheap labels made up that were kind of generic, and I would add on, like I did lots of different scents and flavors,
mm-hmm.
and would just write in what the flavor was, and I do craft shows and farmers markets as well.
Yeah.
But after a while, I thought, well, I really need to get it into the hands of people, and what better way than to get it into stores and eventually have a website.
Yeah.
Works wonders for the people that come and visit in Vermont, but then go back home and want some.
Oh, my gosh. I can't even count how many I have taken back to Pennsylvania for people, and they're stunned.
I know.
Yeah, right. It's
your family orders and friends. It's wonderful.
That is absolutely
and I thank
the
you
truth.
Also, I don't know if you remember this, Rick, but it was your idea to come up with some sort of a body butter, which was how Bohemian Body Butter was born.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to those other products, but that's right, the body butter. Julie, you, when we took a break, we talked about you were selling the Bee Balm at farmers markets, decided to start distributing it more widely. So how did you go about that? How did you turn your farmers market business into more of a statewide business?
Well, I tell you, I asked people in stores, asked for suggestions on what would sell a product in their store. And when I first started out, my label said Black River Bee Balm.
Oh.
Because we have the Black River near us here in Craftsbury.
Mm-hmm.
And I had quite a few people say, you've got to have Vermont in your name to sell a Vermont product. So we switched it to Vermont Bee Balm. And I was racking my brains because I knew people wouldn't want the canoe shapes like I gave you. And
right.
So we decided to do tins. And at that time, we just had the original Bee Balm with
yeah.
the yellow label. And I came up with I also got a good suggestion from a fellow who had been in retail a long time. He said I needed a place of purchase display.
Yep.
So we came up with a wooden display. And that's how I first armed myself and went out and started just going to any store that would carry it.
Do you remember the first store that said yes?
I believe, and I apologize if I'm wrong, but I believe it was Willie's store.
Oh, no kidding. Good for them.
In Greensboro.
Yeah, nicely done. Yeah, and so it did have a great presentation compared to the canoe shapes, even though I still have, like you do, warm feelings about it. It saved my hands. It didn't matter what shape it came in. And didn't you at one point, Julie, have someone like in Spain flogging this stuff for you?
In Spain?
Yeah, or somewhere in Europe. Am I wrong about that?
I had someone in Spain that wanted to make it over there.
Oh, interesting.
And they started looking into the process, and as it turned out, it didn't work out for them.
Nah.
That happened with someone in Canada as well.
Huh.
And it seems like people that get it in their hands, they're so excited that it works that they just want to spread the word. And I have to thank, you know, all of our customers for spreading the word, because it's just been amazing. I mean, it's just my husband and I that do this business out of our house. And people might think we're a big business, but as a joke, a few years ago, my husband bought me a little Tonka, what do you call that thing? Thing that lifts up. A little Tonka toy.
Uh-huh.
Because people must think we're a big business and have this big warehouse, but no, it's just our house.
Like a forklift? A Tonka forklift?
A forklift, thank
yeah.
you.
All right.
I'm 58 years old. And
it's all right, yeah. I'm right there, too. I grasp for words and concepts all the time. So where is Vermont B-Bomb available now?
It is available in most all natural food stores and tourist-type places. Although since the pandemic, we've lost quite a few of the touristy-type gift shops that had to shut down. But yes, and if you can't find it in your area, I'm always welcome an email, and I'll let you, tell you where to pick it up.
Sure, and VermontBBomb.com is your website address. Let's go to South Royalton. We've got Harry on the line. Harry, go right ahead.
Yeah, I was interested in trying out your product. I used beeswax for years, and my supplier disappeared, and my hands, I can count 9 places on my hands that are cracked and bleeding right now.
Oh, we got to get you some of this.
I wondered where it would be available in my area.
Julie, anywhere near South Royalton for Harry?
Absolutely. Luckily, you can find it right in South Royalton at the South Royalton Market.
At the co-op. All right.
It is.
Great.
Get over there, Harry.
All right. I'll try it out.
All right.
I fall back on Bag Bomb all the time.
Yeah, but you're going to find this.
One question for you.
Go ahead.
Is I worked construction and carpentry and finish work for years. Does it leave an oily film on wood? Because once you leave oil on wood, you can't work it. You can't finish it, paint it. Paint won't stick to it, anything.
Right. So you probably wouldn't want to put some on and then immediately touch wood. But if you put it on in the morning when you first get up, and then as you go about your morning routine and whatnot.
All right. And also,
I would recommend for you to do it morning and evening.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I do with the stuff I use right now. But it's. And also, a problem I had because I worked with a guy that milked organic cows.
Mm-hmm.
Bag Bomb is not allowed. If I use it on my hands, I couldn't milk his cows. Because
absolutely. And we actually have a product called Original Beast Bomb, which is a softer bomb, which you might prefer to use on yourself and perhaps the cows because... it was developed for a farm in East Hardwick. They recommended that I make it something softer that they can put on their cows' teats, like in the spring when the mud starts to get on them.
Yeah, well,
and that is a
see, I couldn't
use.
Because they use antiseptic in Bag Bomb.
Right,
I was not even allowed to handle the milkers.
Yeah.
Because that stuff was on my hands.
All right. So, Harry,
I
thank you a lot for your information.
All right. Perfect.
I'm headed right by the co-op shortly, and I'll pick some up.
Get in there. B-Bomb and Beast Bomb are what you want to look for. Thanks, Harry. Julie, we do need to talk about the body butter. Tell people about that. That's a great product as well.
Was developed as a result of speaking to you. We only had the one product at the time, and you said to me, Julie, what if I want to, moisturize my entire body? What am I going to do? And I was like, oh, that's right. So
that's things I think about. So, yes.
Well, it's very important to be moisturized.
Mm-hmm.
So I experimented and cocoa butter was a big ingredient, and we put lots of beeswax in it, as much as we can, because this body butter will stay on your skin. You don't have to put it on every day. It's one of those every few days, total moisture, you know, moisturize your entire body.
Yep. And
it has a nice lemongrass scent.
Yeah, it is fabulous. You've got the Beast Balm you mentioned. And then what's the Orange Butter Balm?
Orange Butter Balm is just an alternative to the Bee Balm in the tin. It has cocoa butter and orange oil added to the beeswax and olive oil. And people tell us, and it does smell exactly like those chocolate oranges that you eat around yeah. Christmas time.
Yes, they do.
Mm-hmm.
And the other product,
nice aromatherapy.
Yep, and should mention too, you have lip balms as well. So these are all in the Vermont Bee Balm line. And Julie Devlin Brochu is the founder, the owner of Vermont Bee Balm in Craftsbury. You can learn more at VermontBeeBalm.com. Julie, thank you for keeping me in this wonderful place, and of course, thanks for being on the show this morning.
Thanks so much, Rick.
And, you know, Harry's going to thank you as well in South Royalton.
I'm hoping to hear from him.
Yeah, me too. All right, take care. We're going to take a break for a top of the hour CBS News update, and then we're going to discuss Ukraine with Norwich University Diplomacy and International Relations Professor Lasha Shantaritze. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. It's like a dull ache. As I go through my daily routine, I start to think that life is good, but I feel disconcerted. Something isn't right. And even though it's happening an ocean and a continent away, I can't shake thoughts of what's happening in Ukraine right this moment, what terror is being wrought on the people of this independent country. It's even more poignant because my family is from Slovakia, which was once under Soviet control and abuts Ukraine's western border. This morning, we are discussing the situation with an expert from Norwich University. Dr. Lasha Shantaritze is a professor of diplomacy and international relations. His expertise is in Russian foreign policy and Russian-NATO relations, and he joins us now. Dr. Shantaritze, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. Listeners, to ask our guests about the war in Ukraine, you can call us 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I'd like to get a bit of a historical context on Ukraine. When and how did Ukraine lose its independence and become part of Russia or the USSR?
Initially, Ukraine lost its independence in the 17th century when it became a subordinate state to the Russian state based in Moscow. And since that time, its sovereignty and its national culture was slowly eroded, more dominant Russian culture, specifically because Ukrainian church independence was taken away from Kiev. Kiev was the original seat of the church, of the Orthodox Church in the Eastern Slavic lands.
Mm-hmm.
So that was moved to Moscow, and then church became Russified slowly. In terms of identity, Ukrainians have preserved, obviously, their identity, but their statehood was lost. They regained the statehood briefly during the Russian Revolution in the 1917. From 1917 to 1921, there was a revolution followed by a civil war in the former Russian Empire. And then the number of states that belonged to that empire tried to regain independence. A couple of them have been successful, specifically Finland and Poland. But however, others like Ukraine, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia only enjoyed brief independence. And then by end of 1921, all of them were captured back now by the Soviet Russia. And it stayed within the Soviet Union until 1991, when it was dissolved and Ukraine became independent.
Now, Doctor, it seems as though 2014 was another turning point in Russian-Ukraine relations. So what happened that year?
2014 was the year when Yanukovych, president of Ukraine, was overthrown in a civil uprising, which the Russian Federation, specifically President Putin and his government, saw as an American-funded and inspired coup in Ukraine. President Yanukovych was a pro-Russian leader, and the immediate reason for people rising against his rule was his refusal to sign an association agreement with the European Union. Now, European Union is an economic organization, and Ukraine was seeking to have certain free trade arrangements. And Yanukovych was willing to do it, but the last moment when the agreement actually came through, he was allegedly told by Moscow not to do it.
Wow.
That triggered an uprising, spontaneous uprising, turned violent, and to prevent further violence, Yanukovych left the country. That was, you may recall, during the Sochi Olympic Games.
Oh, right.
In southern Russia. Mm-hmm. Sochi is south of Ukraine. And for Russia, that presented a danger. Serious danger of situation in Ukraine going out of control. And indeed, pro-American forces, organized groups, political groups, capturing power. So to prevent that and to retain its presence, its dominant presence in Ukraine, they invaded Crimea.
Right.
And then they pro-Russian groups there declared Crimea to be an independent state after a referendum, which they were themselves organized. And after it was, and that happened within a couple of weeks, and then the next day Crimea asked the Russian Federation, allegedly as an independent state, to be accepted as part of the Russian Federation, which Moscow satisfied, I think, the following day. So it became, essentially has been annexed by Russia. To keep Crimea within the Russian Federation and to have bargaining tool against Ukraine, Russia then funded uprisings and insurgencies in few of provinces of Ukraine where it had supporters and followers and the armed saboteurs. Two of them have been successful, which is Luhansk and Donetsk regions. So about one-third of those provinces ended up being controlled by armed groups loyal to Moscow. Now, Russia needed these parts of Ukraine to bargain with Ukraine so that Ukraine would sign a treaty with Russia by accepting these breakaway regions back within the Ukrainian federal state. Ukraine currently is a unitary state, but the proposal envisions Ukraine to become a federal state. But Russia wanted Crimea to be kept within Russia. And that is so-called outline of the so-called Minsk Agreement, which Moscow has insisted since 2014 Ukraine had to agree to. That agreement was updated in 2018, and still Ukraine refused to sign it, because by signing such an agreement, it was granting those parts of breakaway regions, Donbas and Donetsk, Donetsk and Luhansk regions, a veto power of Ukraine joining any military organization or alliance in the future. This was one thing. The second, if Ukraine signed an agreement, Crimea would have stayed within the Russian Federation forever, and Ukraine would have lost any legal claim over Crimea. And Ukrainian government, specifically government of President Zelensky, was not willing to cede its territory, legitimate territory, to Russia. And that was an immediate trigger for this invasion.
And Dr. Shantaritsa, Crimea, is that more of a bargaining chip that Russia holds, or does it have real geographical importance to Russia?
It has tremendous geographical importance for Russia, specifically for the Russian Navy. Crimea controls the city of Sevastopol, who is a huge Navy base, which hosts a huge Navy base, is the part of Crimea that Russia really wants. That city is located in the southmost part of Crimea, so it's literally in the middle of the Black Sea. Strategically, it controls all the surrounding countries and surrounding areas. And remember, Russia is a nuclear state. Its Black Sea fleet, the Black Sea Navy, is armed with nuclear-capable missiles. And these are most advanced missiles, cruise missiles, in existence. By controlling Crimea, it guarantees its dominance over the Black Sea region, its access to the Mediterranean region, its access to Syria and Libya, which are strategically very important for Russia, because Russia's dominance and Russia's material success is based on its control of oil and gas reserves. Not only that, more recently Russia deploys 3 to 5 very quiet diesel submarines to the Mediterranean basin. And those submarines carry cruise missiles. And those cruise missiles have ballistic warheads, nuclear warheads on them.
Right.
And each of them is, each submarine is capable of completely destroying a medium-sized country. And that now is how Russia tries to intimidate its neighbors, in Europe specifically, because it sees NATO as an existential threat, which President Putin has pointed out a number of times. In short, to keep Crimea, it's most important for the Russian state, for its military power, for its military dominance, because it's the only place that provides Russian access to warm seas in the south.
Let's go to Elmore and speak with Don. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Rick, and your guest. I have a problem with your guest's geography.
All right.
There are two areas in Ukraine that have basically been broken away. They're both in the Donbas. One is Donetsk itself, the other is Luhansk.
Right.
And I believe it was in Luhansk where Putin had his famous Colonel Strelkov, who was a veteran of the Afghanistan issue, and he suddenly disappeared about 6 months ago. I have not been in Ukraine since last August. I have spent a considerable amount of time there, as well as in Russia, having been married to a Russian for some years. As far as the Black Sea is concerned and Sevastopol, there are other places on the Black Sea, that are Russian territory that could be equally as good for a Navy base as Sevastopol. I've been to the Navy base in Sevastopol. The submarine base, unless things have changed and moved over there, was at Balaklava, under a mountain on the south side of Balaklava. I have been there, too. It is now a museum. And this whole thing, as far as I'm concerned with the Crimea, would not have come to pass if we had had anybody in the White House with any intestinal fortitude at the time. The troops that were sent into the Crimea had no insignia on their uniform. Why? Because Putin had studied their history, saw what happened in Cuba in 1964, and realized that if he was challenged, he could have pulled those troops back and denied any knowledge of what was going on. I am ashamed of the lack of intestinal fortitude in Obama and now in Biden when it comes to standing up to Putin. The other thing we would gain by standing up to Putin is a message to Beijing that they clearly need from the way they're acting in the South Pacific. That's all I have to say.
All right, Don. Thanks for your comments. So, you know, Don's saying the Russians already had, you know, presence on the Black Sea, didn't need Crimea. Dr. Shantsaritse, what's your response to that?
Don is perhaps correct in terms of timid response by the United States, and it hasn't been only Obama and the Biden administration that has been very cautious and timid. The Trump administration did no better. It made some progress with, personally, Mr. Trump made some progress with Mr. Putin, but in terms of improving understanding or bringing this conflict to an end in Ukraine, they didn't achieve much. So in terms of Balaklava, yes, Don is correct. Balaklava has been a base, but Balaklava now is a suburb of Sevastopol. It is also in Crimea. Only other access to the Black Sea that the Russian Federation has is Novorossiysk. Novorossiysk, for some time in the 1990s and the early 2000s, was actually considered by the Russian government as an alternative to Sevastopol. But it is very shallow. It is very shallow. Access to Novorossiysk is very hard, especially impossible for submarines and very difficult for large Navy vessels. They tried to enlarge the area to dig up. Russian government once said about $5 billion dedicated to the project, but they gave up because it's geographically, geologically, it's nearly impossible. Besides, no Navy can sustain itself with one access to the sea only. You cannot have one Navy base and call yourself a dominant player in the area. For that reason, in 2008, Russia also captured parts of Georgia, specifically Abkhazia in northwest Georgia. And there is a place there called Ochamchira, which used to have the Soviet submarine base, and after capturing Abkhazia, rather proclaiming it to be an independent state, but it's essentially it's a dependent satellite on Russia. They reactivated that facility as well. In terms of two breakaway regions, collectively, that region is known as Donbas. In the Russia, that's what Russians call it. There are two self-proclaimed republics there that are centered around two major cities, Donetsk and Luhansk. Mm-hmm. And they are now, according to the Russian version of the events, independent states fighting against Ukrainian regime. And formally, that's what Russians presenting themselves as. Russia is assisting allied states in their effort to topple this allegedly Nazi regime in Kiev.
Well, Doctor, so that was the rationale that Mr. Putin used to enter into Ukraine, enter into those that region in the east of Ukraine. So how does he justify now moving Russian forces closer and closer to the capital?
Well, his objective, as far as I understand, and that's what he stated in his declaration of war, was demilitarization and denazification of Ukraine. So he wants to essentially to capture, kill, or eject the current government from Kiev. And that's why the Russians adopted this very bizarre strategy of driving on highways with their military equipment and rushing to Kiev, while more conventional battles are waged between Ukrainian army facing those breakaway regions in the southeast. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what Putin wants to achieve is to capture Kiev and install its own puppet government there, and then sign an alliance or a treaty with it and call it a day. Mm-hmm. Whether there would be an insurgency subsequently in Ukraine, there would be civil war, it's no business of his. That's how he imagined. He wants Ukraine to be destroyed. If war in Ukraine, within Ukraine, lasts for decades, it's all the better to him. He wants Ukraine to be a buffer state, a no-go area for NATO, and if Russia doesn't have access to it, so be it. Specifically, he hoped to control the left bank of the Dnipro River, which is the eastern part of Ukraine. He was sold a bridge by his planners and his advisors, convincing him that on the left bank, people were pro-Russian. They would greet the Russian troops with flowers. They would welcome and cooperate with the Russian occupational forces. But that amazingly then turned out completely false. And as Russian soldiers sometimes report back home and report back to their friends or families or tell to their captors, everyone was shooting. Everyone, they're essentially fighting against the people, entire nation. And that is a war that no country can win.
Mm. We have about a minute and a half left. Should we be concerned about Vladimir Putin's nuclear threat?
We should not be concerned. We shouldn't worry about it, because there is nothing that we can do if he decides to attack the United States. Specifically, traditionally, the Russian, the Soviet nuclear missiles, ballistic missiles, have been targeted. We are the targets on the eastern seaboard. So if he decides to launch a massive nuclear attack, there is not much we can do. So don't worry about it. But he can use nuclear weapons. That is something that he has considered for a long time. He changed the Russian law, has been changing Russian laws, and updating Russian weapons specifically to use nuclear weapons in tactical situations, on battlefields, against smaller states, against states that have no nuclear weapons to retaliate, and to solve war situations like we are having today. So Russia can use nuclear weapons. There is no question about it. In fact, I would say that the danger of Russia using nuclear weapons is the highest it's ever been since the invention of nuclear weapons.
Oh, my. We have to leave it there, Doctor. Dr. Lasha Shantanritse is a professor of diplomacy and international relations at Norwich University. Dr. Shantanritse, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
You're welcome, Rick. Take care.
Very informative. All right. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to meet a James Beard Foundation honored chef in Randolph. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Warren Village is a picture-perfect snow globe this time of year. We invite you to visit us at the almost world-famous Warren store. Come for breakfast, lunch, or après-ski. Have a signature deli sandwich, a hearty soup, or a specialty coffee drink paired with a sweet treat from our incredible bakery. Upstairs is a cornucopia of delightful and unique finds from men's, women's, and children's clothing to gifts, toys, games, jewelry, hats, gloves, and scarves. Best one-stop shopping in Vermont, according to Yankee Magazine. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. A couple of weeks ago, on my most recent stop in Randolph on the WDEV 90th anniversary tour, I made a big mistake. I didn't stop for lunch at Sap Northern Thai Restaurant. I didn't know. I did not know. No one told me, said the man offering the weakest excuse in the world. It took the James Beard Foundation to wake me to the wonders of what's going on at SAP. You see, their chef, Rung Morgan, was selected as a semifinalist for Best Chef in the Northeast. Joining me now is Rung Morgan. Good morning, Rung.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. And her husband and co-owner of SAP, Steve Morgan. Steve, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Listeners, to ask Rung and Steve about SAP, the restaurant, not what you're all waiting to start flowing out in the sugar bush, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint at radiovermont.com. Steve, when did you open SAP Restaurant in Randolph?
It'll be 7 years this April.
Wow. And what other restaurants have you worked at here in Vermont?
Well, I started out as a young chef at Chez Henri at the base of Sugar Bush.
Mm-hmm.
I also worked for David and Kathy Neal at the Partridge Inn in Stowe. And then I moved to Florida for a bit, came back and worked at National Life Insurance, and ending up eventually running the kitchen there for a few years. Through that, I became involved with New England Culinary Institute and became an instructor there, taught for about 12 years. Left NECI to go to Gifford Medical Center with another instructor trying to reinvent hospital food.
Wow, interesting.
And through that process at Gifford, ended up meeting my wife, and that was that. We opened a little restaurant in Randolph, and here we are, James Beard nominee.
I know. And please tell us how you met Rung.
On Match.com.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'd gone through a divorce, and I'd gone on a couple Match.com dates, and a friend of mine said, you know there's international Match.com? And at the time, I was kind of studying a bit of Eastern philosophy and things, and so I thought, oh, Thailand sounds very interesting. And I always been interested in Thai cuisine, and so I met Rune on there, and we talked for about 6 months, and I eventually bought a ticket to Bangkok, and we met.
Oh my gosh, I love it so much. Now Rung, SAP offers northern Thai cuisine, so what is that? What typifies the food from this part of Thailand?
What makes Isan cuisine what it is?
Thai food.
Yeah, the food where you're from. Why is it northern? Why is it an Isan restaurant, not just a Thai?
Because I come from Isan. I come from Khon Kaen. But I really, really want to make Isan food, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this, not too much Isan food, really, but Thai food. And but I make same what I want to eat.
Right.
Same I want all pad kapao, but everywhere in Thailand have pad kapao, but Isan really kiao pala, bong pala, about that.
Maybe I can help clarify a little
sure,
bit. She's
sure,
from
sure.
a region. So Thailand has basically four culinary regions. The north, or actually she's from the northeast. When you say to a Thai person the north, That means Chiang Mai or Chiang Rai near Burma.
I gotcha.
She's actually from a region in the northeast called Isan. Mm-hmm. And the language they speak there is the same language they speak in Laos. And the food is very much like you would find it in Laos.
Ah.
Their staple rice is sticky rice, not jasmine rice.
Mm-hmm.
They grew jasmine rice at home, but it all went into the city. They would only eat sticky rice at home on the farm. It's a very spicy region of Thailand. They eat almost anything that walks or crawls.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of internal organs. And just a lot of fruits and vegetables and herbs that you don't see on many American Thai restaurant menus.
Gotcha. Well, Steve, SAP is a great name for a restaurant in Vermont, but this is spelled S-A-A-P. So tell us the story behind the name of the restaurant.
Okay. So to a Thai person, if you say something is delicious, you say it's aloy or aroy. But in Isan, where they speak the same language they speak in Laos, you say sap.
So we were all
sitting around the table at my in-laws eating with sticky rice, and everybody's saying sap, sap lai de. It means it's really delicious. So I said, oh, that sounds like a Vermont word. And it's one syllable. And people could remember it. And it means delicious in Laos. I think it just was a good fit. And it's two A's just because there was so many other companies that already had SAP as their initials.
Sure.
So there wasn't very many that were SAAP. So that's why.
Gotcha. Now, Rung, when did you decide to become a professional chef?
When did you decide to become a chef? What made you want to be a chef?
Yeah.
When I opened a restaurant. I thinking about I cook.
So she's never been a chef outside of SAP.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
She's never cooked professionally, even in Thailand.
And yet she's been honored by the James Beard Foundation.
I know. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
I'm not very good cook, you know, but I live in America. I'm not very good to speak English, but I'm thinking what I can do for my life. Very good for me, because if I go another job and not to talk English, and I not very understand too much, and
sure.
I talk with my husband. I want open Thai restaurant, and I talk with my husband about that. And
I think to clarify a little, the reason why our restaurant is so unique is most Thai people come to this country and open restaurants not to celebrate their cuisine. They come here to put their kids through college and pay their mortgage. And if you can take some poached chicken and rice noodles and make pad Thai and people pay for it, it's a risk doing things that people have not heard before, don't understand how to eat. So it was a risk doing what we did. But I knew from the first time I traveled in Thailand with Rung and ate at her family's house that if she could cook some of this food in the U.S., and we paired it with local beer and local cider, that people would come for it because it's really difficult to find authentic Thai food. And, well, in New York City and like Flushing, Queens, and parts of, there's a big Thai community in North Hollywood, California, those places you can. But other than that, it's kind of going the way of the Chinese restaurants where people come in and expect to see, you know, spring rolls, pad Thai, drunken noodles.
Yeah.
You know, actually I fought with Rune a little bit before we opened. I was like, Rune, I don't want to have pad Thai on the menu. and she said, why? Americans would want that and they want to come get it. I said, I don't want to be like the Italian restaurants that are still serving chicken parmesan, spaghetti and meatballs. You can set yourself apart in cuisine, and that's what I think we've done.
Wow. Hey, let's take a call from Randolph Center. Mary's joining us. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning, Rick. Hi, Steve and Rune. Oh, it's so congratulations
Hi.
To you.
Yeah.
I've worked with Rune here in Randolph Center quite some time ago at the Three Stallion Inn, and he would grace us.
Oh,
you could walk into the inn and it just smelled, I mean, my mouth would water. And so I'm so happy for you. Congratulations.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thanks, Mary. Do you remember working with Mary at the Three Stallion Inn room?
Yeah.
Oh, that's,
I have to work there.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Steve, before I get to some of those dishes, let's talk about this James Beard Award. Is this something that Rung applied for, was nominated for? How did this come about?
A few days ago, I walked into the restaurant for lunch, and there was a message on the answering machine from Darren Perrin from WCAX. And he said, have you heard that the James Beard Awards were issued for 2022 this morning? And I said, I don't really follow that. And he said, well, your wife has been nominated as a semifinalist for Best Chef in the Northeast. And I didn't know what to do or say. I'm gobsmacked. I think there's only 10 other chefs in all of New England that were nominated in that category.
Yeah. So you didn't even know she was being considered.
Nope, and they didn't. They still, the James Beard Foundation still hasn't contacted me. I called them and spoke with them about maybe how we were nominated, et cetera. But that, I guess that's very secretive.
Oh my goodness!
And yeah, and so they said, even as a semifinalist, you are now part of being able to use the James Beard logo on your menu and on your website and acknowledgement. That's going to send us a big plaque and everything, but they haven't contacted us quite yet. But it's a huge honor.
Yeah, it is. Rung, how did you feel when you found out that you were honored in this way?
Oh, I feel my husband told me, I not believe about that.
Yeah.
And my husband, I said, wow, I beam, but not beam that, really? Yes. Mm. My husband watch TV about cooking all time, you know, and I feel in my heart about, oh, I want same them, but I same beam, you know?
Yeah.
But today, my husband walked in the kitchen, and then he told me about that. Mm. Really? Wow!
And I don't know if she really fully understands the gravity of it. It's like the biggest culinary award in the country.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I don't know how really big about KMB, you know, but I know about a chef, American chef, very good about this, about that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I dim. My husband talked with me. He's very exciting. He talk again, all day, all night.
Oh, he
not
man.
Believe. He not believe. I not believe too about
yeah.
this. Why we live very, very far away from city, and then them see us and tell me all the bad shit in the. Can be for 10, 11 people. I not believe about that. And my husband told me about website.
Oh, it's so
about,
great.
About can be, you know, and that. And
yeah. Well, now, I'm an adventurous eater. I'm an adventurous eater, Rung. If I walked in, Steve, help her out here. Now, if I walked in and I told Rung to just make me something wonderful, and I'm pretty adventurous, what dish would Rung make for me?
I'd say at this point, there's some specials that we're running that are a little adventurous, but probably one thing on our menu that you don't see much outside of Thailand is a dish called Khao Kluk Gapi, which gapi is fermented shrimp paste.
Mm-hmm.
So it's jasmine rice mixed with garlic and scallion and this fermented shrimp paste, and then there's garnishes around the outside of it. Sweet pork, young mango, of still crispy, like an apple, shredded, shredded warmed egg, red onion. What else is it? How could it be? And fresh green beans and cucumber. And so you pull all of these things, bits at a time, into this rice that's perfumed with shrimp paste.
Yeah, I think it's really good.
Mm.
It's really good, yeah. I tell, you know, at Excel and sell for customer. And then someday, oh, I'm hungry. What I want to eat? I try to eat cow kukapi because I don't eat long time. I only make for customer, you know.
Yeah.
And then I eat, oh, cow kukapi, very alloy.
So yeah, I'd say that's one of the more adventurous things. We often run before COVID, we would go to Boston once a month and go and find different things that are special.
Yeah.
I would buy, I don't know if you know durian. It's a fruit from Southeast Asia that's a lot of people find it offensive. It's not allowed on buses or into hotels because of the odor, but it's delicious. And there's, what else have we run, Room, that's interesting? We run cow kamu, braised pork leg with hard-boiled eggs and star anise broth with pickled mustard greens and bok choy.
Well, there's a soup. There's a soup you have, number 11, Tom Yum Potek.
Potek. Yeah.
Potek, you tell us about that. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, the fact that it's Potek is it's served in a little dish, a vehicle that looks like a moat. So in the center is a little chimney. And in Thailand, they use charcoal, but we use sterno. We light a little fire inside there. And then in this moat on the outside goes this savory seafood broth that's flavored with lemongrass and kaffir lime leaves. And a thing called galangal, which is a rhizome in the same family as ginger, but it's more camphory. So that plus seafood made into a broth. And then in the bottom of the container, you put scallion, basil, Thai basil, cilantro, lime juice, a little touch of palm sugar, and fish sauce. And the reason why she puts the aromatics in the bottom of the container is when the hot broth hits it, it starts to perfume. If you put it in on the stove and it cooks for any amount of time, anything that's volatile goes up the chimney. You want these herbs just blooming when it comes to the table and you take the lid off.
Mm. Oh,
but that's
my.
A delicious dish.
It sounds fabulous. All right. So do you know when Rung finds out if she's a finalist for this award?
I think it's March 16th.
Okay.
It's either the 13th or the 16th. I have it written down. We're just so honored just to be mentioned for this piece of it.
Sure.
And the competition that we're up against is so stellar. But if she does move on to the next round, one of my kind of heroes is a man called Andy Ricker, who won a James Beard Award for best chef in the Northwest. This was some years ago, maybe 15 years ago. And he has a restaurant called Pok Pok and came out with a cookbook. And so it was saying, if maybe there's a possibility of cooking honest, authentic Thai food, there's a possibility of winning this. I'm not sure. But if we go to the next round, the celebration after that would be in Chicago.
Oh my.
In June. And I'd have to, rent a tuxedo.
Well, it really is a great honor. Rung and Steve Morgan are the owners of SAP, Northern Thai Restaurant in Randolph. Rung was recently chosen as a semifinalist for the James Beard Award in the Best Chef in the Northeast category. And you can start looking for what you're going to have for lunch at saprestaurant.com. I know I'm not going to make this mistake twice when I get to Randolph. I'll be tucking in there next time. I want to congratulate you both and thank you both for being on the show today.
Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. Bye-bye. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivrigan, and you can feel free to suggest guests or topics by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast or subscribing at wdevradio.com. And the podcast is sponsored by The Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. We've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre up next, but no COVID-19 response news conference today because of town meeting day. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we hear about the policing situation in Bennington and we learn about those delicious ice cream treats made by Rhino Foods.